Mrs. Chatterton, Ms. Lotler.
May it please the court, I would like to introduce myself. I am Attorney Catherine Kleckler with UAWGM Legal Services in Janesville, Wisconsin. I represent the debtor, Wayne Crawford, who is the appellant in this case. Before I begin, I'd like to note an slight error in my reply brief regarding the case of Chapman. In that brief, I say that Chapman is an example of the minority position on the preference to student loans, when in fact it is a majority position. The case is before the court on the denial of confirmation of my client's Chapter 13 plan under 11 U.S. Code 1325, because the Bankruptcy Court of the Western District of Wisconsin concluded that my client's plan did not comply with all provisions of the code.
Do you read the bankruptcy court and then the district court's decision as essentially saying there can be no classes within the group of unsecured
creditors? That's how I read it. I think it is a very narrow, restrictive interpretation.
Yeah. Can I ask you a factual question real quickly? You have, of course, or your client has this $18,000 and some unsecured claim for past due child support that was assigned to Rock County, and it's non-dischargeable. Will interest continue to accrue on that claim during the period of the bankruptcy?
Yes.
So he could wind up at the end of the bankruptcy owing the same amount or more as he owes today if it's a straight pro rata allocation among the unsecured creditors?
Correct. And that was part of my concern when I did put the plan together, because the original claim for the child support is about $11,000, and he's accumulated roughly $7,000 in interest, and the clock keeps running.
So the clock is running on the interest, and I guess then the next question is, then when he emerges from the bankruptcy, Rock County can still enforce that claim through the whole panoply of measures, including the criminal sanctions, et cetera?
Correct. And since the court, after this case went before the district court, new law came into being through 42 U.S. Code 666. And in Wisconsin, I believe that is statute 49, what this does is it creates a lien docket against any of my client's property, being it real estate, personal property, cash accounts, whatever. It's my understanding, although I'm not a family law attorney, it's my understanding that those liens get a priority like a judgment lien would. They run for 5 years, and among other penalties under that statute, you can lose your various licenses that are provided by the state. So there are other consequences to his non-payment.
Now, are you making the argument that if that's the case, that his current payments to his ex-spouse will also be threatened?
He's current.
Yeah.
And he's under wage assignment. So as long as he continues to be employed, through various layoffs or what have you, because of the slowdown in the economy, GM is very sensitive to that in terms of the production of vehicles. But as long as he continues to work and the wage assignment holds, he should be fine on his current support payments to the spouse directly.
Okay.
What I find troublesome about your case is that your client is using a rule about non-dischargeability to deprive his creditors, the general creditors, of their entitlement. I don't understand the equity of that.
Well, that is a good question. And of course, the whole bankruptcy code is set up in terms of trying to balance the rights of the debtor to his fresh start against what is fair to a creditor. And I understand that.
Yes, but when Congress decides or a state decides that a particular type of debt is non-dischargeable, that's a judgment that is then nullified if the entire if the non-dischargeability feature can be eliminated at the cost of the general creditors. I mean, suppose this fellow had. I mean, suppose this was this non-dischargeable debt was a criminal fine. Then by this scheduling, he can in effect he can have the general creditors bear the consequences of non-dischargeability. Right?
Well, that is.
I mean, in effect, he converts this non-dischargeable debt into a completely discharged debt, right?
Well, it won't.
That's the effect.
It won't be completely discharged, but.
Well,
you're
whatever.
Correct in
that. That's the effect of this kind of schedule. I can think of a lot of. It seems to me the purpose of scheduling, the legitimate purpose, would be a situation where you have two sets of creditors and you have to choose between them, and there's some reason why one group of general creditors should be paid a higher percentage of their claim than the other. I have absolutely no quarrel with that. But here, if discharge is refused, all the creditors are paid, right? So this isn't a matter of creditors fighting with each other. This is the bankrupt fighting with the creditors and trying to get an advantage, which I think the law denied him when it said that this wasn't a dischargeable debt.
Well, to begin with, there is no argument with the other general creditors because none of them filed an objection to the way that the plan was set forth. And certainly the IRS...
What should we take from that with regard to resolving this problem?
In some of the cases that have been decided on this particular issue, the court has held that it is a very important factor if other unsecured creditors who would be, there would be bias against them because of this type of plan, do not step forward to object. That should be considered by the courts as part of the weighing exercise.
Well,
that
but
happens.
The IRS is objecting.
The IRS has not objected to the treatment of the unsecured claim, Your Honor.
There's enough for them? Is that a...
Well, they're getting about $11,000 chunk in terms of a priority claim that they have. That's to be paid first before we get to these unsecured claims. Then IRS has another $19,000 chunk that is an unsecured claim. My point is, certainly IRS knows how to object, and certainly IRS knows how to collect the debt.
So, again, I ask, what should we take from this? You say some courts take
They consider this sometimes to be the deciding factor as to whether, this is fair or not.
But wait, the trustee is objecting. The trustee
correct.
Is, but he's the agent of the unsecured creditors. So why should they object, right? They're going to benefit if they're the ones. I mean, you have the trustee basically is the representative of the unsecured creditors, and the trustee is objecting. Now, he's objecting on behalf of the unsecured creditors.
Correct.
Not on his own behalf.
Correct.
So that's as if the unsecured creditors were objecting, right? What's the difference?
Well, all I'm saying is that courts who have considered this in the past have taken it into consideration.
But I don't understand it. I mean, if you have an agent and your agent takes a certain position, why do you, as a principal, have to say anything?
No point well taken.
So you should say. So your answer to my question is, we shouldn't take anything from it.
I would, in defense of my client, I would say that I believe that there would be some necessity for for a creditor to step forward if they did feel that they were being treated unfairly.
But I don't understand that, because that's what the trustee does. And what I particularly don't understand about this case is it really defeats the policy behind making certain debts non-dischargeable, because what it says to a person like this is, well, okay, I have this non-dischargeable debt, now I'll run up a whole bunch of other debts. Then I'll declare bankruptcy, and I'll wipe out the non-dischargeable debt that way.
Well,
that's precisely what he's doing.
Well, what you're saying is that dollar for dollar, cent for cent, the other unsecureds are paying his way through the Charlie Kirk claim, and that is exactly the position of the lower courts and the trustee in this matter. But the majority of courts that have decided this issue with regard to...
Well, how about a reason?
Okay. The reason
is... non-dischargeability for? Is it to punish people, or is it to make sure the debt's paid?
It's to make sure that the creditor, that the debtor gets his fresh start. In other words, they are...
Why? No, a non-dischargeability means you don't get a fresh start with respect to that debt. But why do we... Why does Congress make some debts non-dischargeable?
I believe that was brought up in the appellee's brief, stating that what that connotes is that the debtor's fresh start has to be conditioned by other things.
Well, right. In other words, some debts have to be paid.
Correct.
Whether it's a criminal fine, or whether it's child support, or whether it's student loans, or whatever the non-dischargeable debt. So I think it depends a lot on what you think the policy is. If it's a policy about making sure that these creditors get paid no matter what, we don't care if there's a discharge in bankruptcy, we don't care what else has happened, they still have to be paid, that's going to happen. If there is some idea beyond that, that we're really trying to punish the debtor by saying that this debt is going to continue even after your bankruptcy is over, that may be another matter.
Well, Section 1322b1 is really a permissive type of thing. It obviously doesn't have to be utilized, but it does permit a debtor to do the separate classification.
Sure, but it's not focused on non-discharge, and Judge Wood's question is important. Now, one answer might be there's a deterrent effect, like with the student loans. You don't want people to take on some immense amount of debt in the thought that they can declare bankruptcy and get rid of it. You want them to know that, you know, there's going to be a consequence. And that deterrent effect seems to me is eliminated by your proposed use of 1322, especially these people who are kind of on the border, you know, of solvency and so on, for whom bankruptcy can become a very attractive way of eliminating these non-dischargeable debts.
Well, I believe you have to look at the reasonability test under the four-prong test as to whether I think that I'm reading these lower court opinions and the position of the appellee is that any discrimination shown in the way that you treat unsecured creditors equals an unfair discrimination.
No, I don't think so, because if the discrimination benefits some creditors at the expense of others, that may be reasonable, but when the only beneficiary is the debtor, then it seems to me much more dubious case for 1322.
Well, I think that the debtor is not the only one who benefits here. I think that the state and local governments benefit by a more immediate payout of this debt.
Why? They're getting all this wonderful interest in the lien?
Well, they're not now.
They have an investment in this.
They are not getting it now.
I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't have it both that they're greedy and extortionate with all this interest running, and also that they're being cheated because they're not getting their lesser amount of money up front.
Well, Rock County and the state of Wisconsin are running huge deficits at this point, and there's been a lot of debate about the fact that aid to people who otherwise would probably get it, and services to communities are going to be cut off because there are no funds. And I think it does make a difference whether these funds get to the local government now or in 10 years' time.
Okay, well, thank you very much,
thank you.
Ms. Folker, and we'll hear from Mr. Chatterton.
May it please the court, I am William Chatterton, a standing Chapter 13 trustee for the Western District of Wisconsin, and the objecting party to the plan in this particular case. The court made the point very well for me that as the trustee, one of my responsibilities is to represent the unsecured creditors and make sure that they obtain as much as possible.
But on, from that point of view, it seems to me logically there's a cap, which is whatever the percentage pro rata payment would be if there were no classes, right, which is here something like 34%.
That's
true. They get 34 cents in the dollar. And what I want to know from you is if you could give me some examples of classifications within the class of unsecured creditors to which you would not object, since by definition any such classification would disadvantage some of the unsecured creditors.
I can do that. If you look at the four-part test, which is on page 16 of the appellant's brief, the second part of the test is whether the debtor can carry out a plan without the proposed discrimination. The most common ones are continuing service providers. If you live in a community where there's one dentist and limited medical help, and you or your family need medical help or dental help, it's not uncommon to see an allowance in a plan for payment of the doctor or dentist bill, because the doctor or dentist is going to be very reluctant to provide continuing service if their prior bill is being discharged or only being paid whatever, 30% on 30 cents on the dollar. Another might be a case of bottle gas. If you live in a rural community where you're dependent on heat and cooking for bottle gas, the bottle gas carrier is not likely to supply you in the future if you're going to discharge his debt or pay only a percentage on the dollar. Another one would be if you're a truck driver or a bus driver and your livelihood depends on keeping your license in good standing, which means that you may have to pay a traffic ticket in order to keep that license in good standing in order to earn your livelihood in the future. So there are examples of that type. It doesn't.
How is the bottle gas different than, say, just any utility bill?
The way the bankruptcy code is structured, the utility really can't discriminate against the debtor who files bankruptcy. They have to provide continuing service, but a bottle gas supplier is not a utility. It's a private company that delivers, as you know, delivers bottle gas to farmers or rural communities. There are things of that type that is the second second test says that whether you can carry out the plan. You can't carry out the plan if you can't work or you can't get medical help or you can't heat your house, that sort of thing. Both are the types of things which are usually approved, or I recommend it to the court, or the court will approve it, that sort of thing.
So would you argue that, first of all, do you agree that during the period of time this plan is in effect, whether it's a three-year period or something longer, that interest will continue to accrue on any debts this man has that are non-dischargeable, which I guess is just the Rock County debt?
I agree with that. It's not uncommon, for instance, IRS claims, same thing.
Unsecured IRS claims.
What?
Not unsecured IRS claims, right?
No, but priority IRS.
Right.
Well, actually, unsecured claims. If a debtor didn't complete the plan, the interest would all, interest and penalties would all be assessed after the plan.
But if the debtor successfully completes the Chapter 13 plan, then the IRS is done with it, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, but the non-dischargeable debts, like the assigned child support claims and student loans do have the interest accruing.
True.
Now, is it your, given that fact, is it your position that under whatever, you know, four-part, five-part, 20-part test we're using, that it is absolutely impermissible as a matter of law to take into account the fact that a certain debt, while non-priority, is non-dischargeable? Is that off the table?
Well, that's what it says, is that the majority of courts, with which I understand the appellant agrees, have concluded that...
But those are all lower, pretty much those are all lower courts, right?
That's
they're
true.
Bankruptcy
that
courts.
The fresh start is not a sufficient basis for separate classification.
And are you arguing that that should be the rule of law that we should adopt, that you can't take into account at all the fact that, you know, particular non-dischargeable debt may be bigger than it was when he started out at the end of the bankruptcy if you don't let him pay at least, you know, the accruing interest plus, you know, another $10 a month?
I think
in other words, he's expressed willingness to renegotiate this particular plan if you don't like, you know, the 3-4% amount.
Well, I think it's true. It's somewhat dependent upon the amount involved, I think. One of the tests of Chapter 13 is that you're making an effort to pay your creditors, and there are Seventh Circuit cases that so hold. One is an effort to pay your creditors and not get out of paying your creditors by paying somebody else. And that's what the lower courts have said here, and Judge Ginsburg said in that very well-reasoned decision of his, which they were following, is that, lost my train of thought there. Sorry about that. What they're saying is that,
I think the question was, can you imagine any case in which it might be appropriate to classify a non-dischargeable debt in such a way that, you know, some other creditors got less from the bankrupt state?
Right. Perhaps not giving it, you know, the full weight that this particular plan did, but even something that said you get to pay an amount that will reduce the principal, interest plus a little bit more each month, and then we'll divide the rest among the unsecured creditors. That might take them up quite a bit.
I think it depends on the amount involved.
Well, here we have...
Here you're reducing it from 30-some percent down to 3%.
Right, and I'm saying, suppose it were a different plan. That's one under which he gets to devote all of the payment to Rock County.
Right.
Suppose he only was entitled to devote interest plus $10 each month to Rock County, and the rest got allocated equally among the rest of the unsecured creditors. They would wind up, presumably, with far more than the current plan would give them. And I'm just wondering why discussions shut off as early as they did in this case, because if there are any circumstances at all under which non-dischargeability can factor into the thinking, maybe this was just the wrong plan, but they should have kept working.
I think that's true.
Well, let me follow up Judge Wood's question. What happens if we affirm? What happens next? Does that just mean his plan was rejected, or what?
That means his plan was rejected. I suppose he could come
back
and propose an amended plan.
So the next step would be for him to propose an amended plan.
That's correct.
If we take your position, it would be appropriate for some lesser amount involved.
I think that's true. I don't know what the court would do.
So you wouldn't completely foreclose the possibility of allowing some I gather some of these cases say that it's improper to it's improper to classify these non-dischargeable debts if it's going to push the general creditors to get less than 20%, something of that sort.
Right.
So is that the idea?
Yeah, that was the point I was trying to make when I lost my train of thought, that there has to be some meaningful payment to the unsecured, other unsecured creditors. In this case, there is no meaningful payment. 3 cents on the dollar when you pay off the other creditor 100%.
Okay, you're not taking the hardest possible line. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. I can see where it would be possible to propose an amended plan which would apply.
But you're just defending the rejection of this plan.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chatterton. Well, Ms. Glocker, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute if there's something further you'd like to say.
You would be willing to renegotiate, would you?
Oh, yeah. And that was brought up in the bankruptcy court at the time that we had the confirmation hearing. I don't know that I agree that the court would, from my understanding of Judge Martin's position when this matter was heard, I don't know that there would be confirmation of a plan if I provided for more payment to the creditor, but not an equal
payment. What if we instructed that it might be a possibility?
Well, then I guess he would have to rethink.
Well, because the only judgment is rejecting the. Is that correct? The only judgment is the rejection of your plan.
Well, the way that it was stated on the
record. He hasn't adopted another plan, has he?
No.
To go back in any event, doesn't it?
He left me 2 weeks. Not if you do what I asked you to do.
Right. But otherwise, if we affirm, there will be further proceedings in bankruptcy court. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, he has given me 2 weeks, and I believe that 2 weeks would probably hold for me to reconstitute the plan. But based on the judge's statements in the court, unless he was instructed that there had to be some leeway, I really believe he has a definitive idea that any type of unequal payment here is wrong.
But if we rejected that flatter rule, he would obviously have to consider a new plan in light of whatever guidelines we set down.
Correct.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both parties.